And we will go on to case number two. And that is Joanne Morgan versus Michael Astru. And it's Mr. Rose, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Ashley Rose. I represent Joanne Morgan, who is the plaintiff appellant in this case. The ALJ writes in his unfavorable decision that Mrs. Morgan could read and cook. She walks to the library. She goes grocery shopping. She attends physical therapy sessions and attends medical appointments. She does her own laundry and does the dishes. Now, he makes a great deal out of this because this, according to the way that his decision turned out, this demonstrates that she has the capability of doing at least sedentary work. Now, one of the there are two contentions that I would like to focus on that were raised in my brief. And that is that neither at step two nor at step four was there any kind of a functional assessment by this administrative law judge as to, for example, how long does she read at one particular point? Sometimes read, but they can't read more than 5 or 10 minutes, and sometimes they can't remember what they read. How long does it take her to cook? To what kinds of physical exertion levels does she approach when she's cooking? Does she carry a turkey or does she put things into the microwave? How far does it take her to walk? I think their record says 4 blocks to the library. How long does it take her to walk? Does she walk in pain? Does she walk slowly, rapidly? When she gets to the library, does she associate with people there? Does she talk to the librarian when she's checking out her books? Or does she keep mum and say nothing to anybody and go home? Those kinds of questions would follow on the other kinds of things that the administrative law judge said. Now, at step two in the sequential evaluation process, I recognize that the administrative law judge gave her the certain severe impairments. But I believe that if one takes into consideration all of the policy statements by the commissioner himself, in my reply brief, I did cite SSR 85-28, for example, at star 3. And also 96-3P, where there is an emphasis upon functional assessment at step two. Now, I realize that the reason at step two is you want to get rid of the, you want to get rid of frivolous claims, of course. But the effect of a functional assessment at step two is to find out which impairments are severe, meaning that they substantially limit a person's ability to function in the workplace. On the other hand, are the non-severe impairments, which only minimally would affect their ability to do so. However, at step two, if there is a functional analysis, then the ALJ would be in a position to look at what SSR 85-28 says, that possibly two or more non-severe impairments could equal a severe impairment. Those kinds of questions are very important, and the claimant is entitled to have the administrative law judge follow the commissioner's policies. In fact, this court has even, and I cite the case of Lauer, there's two Lauers actually, but the all components of the Social Security Administration, including the administrative law judges, are bound by the Social Security rulings. So, in a sense, if one takes just the dicta out of the case of Hickman, which I cite, and I believe that my opponent also cites, I know she also cites it, Hickman, which says that step two is rather kind of a trivial, or it's a kind of a de minimis position, it ignores the basic policies of the commissioner. Now,
can we move back to the severe impairment, because the area, the ALJ agreed that Morgan had a severe impairment relating to anxiety and depression.
Yes, that's correct.
What medical records contradict the ALJ's subsequent finding that the mental impairment was not totally disabling? Are there any medical records that contradict the ALJ's later finding that the mental impairment was not totally disabling?
No, I don't believe so, because there was only the one review. However,
but what evidence from a qualified physician would contradict the RFC by the ALJ?
I think that would be the evidence of Dr. I think his name would be pronounced Szymke or something like that, S-Z-Y-M-K-E, where he talks about the fact that his diagnosis is of ankle pain, myofascial pain, facet sclerosis, and osteoiliitis. Now, those things are not trivial. Those things are those particular conditions certainly can contribute to a person's limitations due to pain.
There's no indication in his report that these conditions are disabling, though.
No, there is not. But I don't believe that that is dispositive. Because I'm sure, as this court is aware, the fact that a physician would suggest that the person is disabled is an irrelevant position. It's only the commissioner who has the right and the statutory and regulatory right to say whether there is a disabling condition, whether the claimant is disabled.
Right. I wasn't suggesting that the doctor, we look to the doctor for a legal conclusion, but there just isn't anything in his report that talks about the degree of impairment on her ability to work these conditions cause.
This is very true.
He just didn't go into that.
I recognize, Your Honor, that this record is rather sparse. And I don't know that the ALJ ever raised the question as to why it's ever sparse. He does raise the question that she wasn't doing some treatment, but he doesn't ask whether or not she had any funds to do so, whether she had any ability to pay for these for a medical treatment.
But you realize it. But we need to see some evidence.
Yes.
Which you're admitting that evidence wasn't there.
Right. Okay. But I'm also saying...
And that evidence then leads to... I mean, that helps us determine whether or not the ALJ made an appropriate finding.
Yes, I understand. But there's also the question here, and I believe that I raised this as well, that she was an unrepresented claimant. I'm not saying that the admonitions were not correct. I didn't raise that issue. But at the same time, when a claimant is unrepresented, there is a duty, a greater duty, and this court has long upheld this duty of the ALJ to more scrupulously develop the record. And one of the things that I would point out to this court is that, curiously, there is no RFC by the state agency contained in the record. If there was any concern by the ALJ that this person, Mrs. Morgan, didn't have enough medical evidence, why didn't he send her out for a...
You're going to have no time. You're going to have almost no time for rebuttal, even if I can give you another minute.
Okay, well, I'll just finish my sentence then, Your Honor. Why didn't he send her out to get a more... current consultative evaluation on a physical level to supplement Dr. Simsky. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Ms. Miller? Morning, Ms. Miller.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kim Sue Miller, Assistant Regional Counsel, on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security.
Can I start you right out? Because what I've been wondering about in this case is where a claimant has such a wide range of physical and mental impairments, which may have a cumulative effect that is very difficult to ascertain. How can an ALJ adequately assess the case without an RFC, without a residual functional capacity assessment from a physician?
Well, indeed, Your Honor, we do have an assessment of the plaintiff's functional capacity from the consultative examiner, Dr. Simke, who saw her and concluded that even though the films had showed she had significant facet sclerosis, as well as some myofascial pain, she nonetheless only needed some soft tissue therapy to treat that. And he didn't...
Are you considering that as an RFC?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that the ALJ properly relied on Dr. Simke's opinion in formulating the RFC in this case, in finding that she was able to perform sedentary work. And, in fact, the ALJ considered not only Dr. Simke's opinion, but also the physical therapy notes that reflected that she was feeling much after treatment in April 2006, for example. She was feeling much better. She reported it was a miracle. The ALJ similarly properly considered the objective medical evidence, including an MRI that showed while there was a disc bulge and some degenerative changes, there were no herniation and no stenosis. So the ALJ properly, consistent with the regulations, reached his RFC determination that she could perform a restricted range of sedentary work.
Well, but isn't it somewhat dangerous where you have a claimant's own assessment of her physical capacity being at odds with that of others, such as her son, for instance? So, you know, there's a danger in relying on her more positive assessment. In other words, isn't it particularly troublesome to rely on her self-assessment where she has mental impairments and her son testifies that her everyday activities are far less than she states?
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ considered a number of factors consistent with the regulations. He considered not only plaintiff's reports of debilitating limitations, as well as calling her son to testify, but the ALJ also considered the physical therapy treatment notes, the objective diagnostic evidence, including the MRI, and the opinion of the consultative examiner, as this all relates to her physical impairments.
Now, I'm zoning in on her mental impairments because the reasons that the ALJ discounted her mental illness really trouble me. He focuses on the lack of treatment for her mental illness, although, as Mr. Rose noted, or somebody noted, might have been Judge Williams, that he failed to address that the lack of treatment is attributable to a lack of money to pay for it. And he states that her depression is not as bad as she says because she can pray and read.
Those were some of the factors that the ALJ considered.
They're bizarre.
The ALJ relied on plaintiff's own reports of her daily activities, including her, as she reported to the agency, she had a love of reading. She read religious stories. She read true stories. She went to the library. The ALJ relied on her ability to shop, on her those reports. The ALJ also relied on the reports that she made to the consultative examiner, Dr. Bacchus, the psychologist, who conducted an extensive examination of her and reached the diagnosis of depression.
And you agree that Bacchus's comment that Morgan would spend her disability benefits on alcohol was inappropriate, don't you?
It may have been an unkind statement.
And he further suggests, in the context of this, it was more than unkind, given what was at stake here for her. But Bacchus further suggests, and the ALJ seems to agree, that her alcoholism caused her depression. Should this inappropriate statement of causation matter for our review? Don't you agree that was inappropriate, too? Was he in a position to make that determination?
Dr. Bacchus?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, Dr. Bacchus is the only medical source who even found that there was a diagnosis of depression, and neither Dr. Bacchus or the ALJ discounts the severity of her mental impairment, of the depression, and her symptoms, regardless of their cause, whether the cause was alcohol, whether the cause was situational. They accepted the allegation of her having depressive symptoms and took her statements, and the ALJ prescribed functional limitations for that depression, regardless of the cause.
And part of why she didn't have any more records about this is because she couldn't afford to pay, right, for a doctor.
Mr. Rose had represented that to the court. I know that plaintiff was able to secure physical therapy for herself following the shopping cart accident.
But not mental.
She did not obtain mental health treatment either through medication or therapy. But Dr. Bacchus's comments, first of all, were appropriately relied on by the ALJ, regardless of the cause of her depression. And secondly, they were based on plaintiff's own reports of her drinking, which were time relevant to the period. Not only had there been a remote history of rehab, but also a very recent history of intoxication and drinking that she herself reported, and so was time relevant to the psychologist's examination.
But her personal history reveals numerous potential sources of mental illness. And, of course, we have cases that say that even if substance abuse exacerbates depression, that fact doesn't prove that the mental illness itself isn't disabling.
That's true, Your Honor, and the ALJ considered that she had depression. The ALJ considered that she had anxiety, and he considered the credibility of her complaints, and he crafted specific limitations to accommodate her impairments. He didn't find that she was free of mental impairment, and indeed he limited her to occasional interaction with coworkers, supervisors, and the general public, and to unskilled jobs to accommodate her specific limitations and impairments.
Getting back to some of her physical issues, the ALJ didn't discuss some of her ailments, such as weakness in the shoulders and hypertension. How do we know that these impairments don't have physical effects that could have changed the RFC?
Well, the ALJ did describe the entirety of the medical evidence, including some of the impairments he did not find severe at step two, including the myofascial pain and her hypothyroidism and hypercholesterol levels. But the ALJ, having considered all of the evidence, including also her GERD,
She's a sick woman, isn't she?
Like many of us, she has several impairments, Your Honor, and the ALJ accommodated those that he found would have a significant impact on her ability to work. So the ALJ, having found at step two that she had these severe impairments, continued on to consider all of her impairments in combination, as he articulated, to assess appropriate limitations. Furthermore, the ALJ considered both, as discussed, her lack of treatment, as well as her ability to engage in daily activities, to find that she was able to perform sedentary work, including the other medical record evidence, as I discussed, the consultative physical and mental examinations, as well as a state agency reviewing psychologist who found she was only mildly restricted in activities of daily living and moderately restricted in other areas of social functioning and concentration, persistence, and pace. So the ALJ's decision was amply supported. There was, unlike Ms. Morgan maintains, there was not a lack of evidence. Indeed, the evidence simply just did not go her way. The ALJ found that there was sufficient evidence to conclude that she was, her RFC was sedentary. In fact, to address Mr. Rose's argument, he talked about some of the ankle pain and the myofascial pain. Indeed, the diagnosis of these impairments found in Dr. Simke's report doesn't equal severity. And while she may have had indicators of these, it certainly didn't mean that they were disabling. And even with the worst case, even considering those diagnoses, the prescription and treatment for them was soft tissue, conservative treatment, which there's no evidence that plaintiff even followed that treatment. And also the ALJ noted his consideration of that evidence, and he simply didn't agree that they were severe impairments. So there were medical records, including physical therapy, that showed that she was not disabled. And while Mr. Rose had mentioned that there was a heightened duty by the ALJ to develop the record, there was no concern by the ALJ that there was not enough evidence. She simply didn't have the evidence to support that she was disabled. We have two consultative examiners. We have a state agency reviewing physician. We have physical therapy notes, and we have diagnostic images, all supporting the ALJ's RFC. Conclusion that she could perform sedentary work.
I have to stop you.
Thank you.
I don't need to. Thank you so much. Okay, Mr. Rose, you have half a minute left, but I'm going to give you, Lady Bountiful, a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that there really is no RFC in this case. An RFC would have taken into consideration how long can she stand, how long can she sit, can she push and pull, how much weight can she lift, how far can she walk. There is really, and that would have been the result of a functional assessment. With regard to the major depression, was really not considered. As this court, I can't remember the name of the case, several years ago stated, a major depression is not the blues. It's something that is a major illness. And the fact that the ALJ gives her an occasional lack of ability to concentrate really is rather inconsistent, because occasionally, by the definition used by the commissioner, occasionally means from 0 to 2 hours out of an 8-hour day. So if she can't concentrate for 2 hours, she should probably not be able to work even at the sedentary level based upon her mental condition. Also, one other point, and then I will stop. With regard to the combining of various impairments, Dr. Simke determined essential hypertension, high blood pressure. That plus anxiety plus lack of concentration, does that equal or does that add up to a severe combination of impairments? I don't think the ALJ ever resolved that. Thank you very much, Court. I appreciate your consideration, and we would ask that this case be reversed or remanded. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. Thank you so much.